Hey everybody, it's Sasha Ann Simons. Just like so many of you, at 1A, we're doing everything we can to help slow the spread of the coronavirus. That means moving as much of our production as we can to our homes. So if you notice the show sounding a little different than what you might be used to, that's why. And we always want to hear your feedback on these episodes. Email 1A at WAMU.org with your comments, questions, and stories. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Happy Earth Day. It's the 50th anniversary of the holiday and a perfect time to talk about the state of our planet. We just closed out the warmest decade on record. Rising sea levels threaten cities and towns around the world, and the rate of severe storms is accelerating. So what are lawmakers doing to combat this pressing threat amid a global pandemic? We talked about that and more with EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler, National Resources Defense Council President Gina McCarthy, and our panel of climate change experts. You can find that conversation on our website, the1a.org. But today on our show, we're talking Cli-Fi, that's fiction about climate change, with three writers. Their work explores the kind of cosmic anxiety that a lot of us feel, that the issue is overwhelming, beyond our grasp, sometimes downright scary. The characters in their novels are perhaps more relatable than ever as they grapple with how to live through a global crisis while also dealing with personal ones. Joining us from New York City is Amy Brady, deputy publisher for Guernica Magazine and editor-in-chief of the Chicago Review of Books. Amy, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, and happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day to you, too. And joining us from Red Hook, New York is Jenny Offill, author of several novels, including her most recent work, Weather. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to 1A.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And joining from Tucson, Arizona is writer and conservationist Lydia Millett. Her latest novel is called A Children's Bible. Lydia, welcome.
Hi there.
Amy, I'll start with you. Your monthly column called Burning Worlds focuses on how fiction writers are addressing climate change in their work. What do you think a novel or a short story can achieve when it's tackling climate change that other mediums can't?
Well, I think that if something like science or news reports alone could solve climate change, then we probably would have already solved it by now.
Right.
Which is not to say that novels and short stories alone can solve climate change, but something that I think has been missing from the larger conversation about climate is kind of the personal, emotional aspect of the phenomenon. Because it's not just the fact that there is a lot more carbon in the atmosphere, it's the effects of that carbon. Mm-hmm. And it's affecting us at every level of our lives. And novels and short stories can make that phenomenon more personal. It can kind of put us in the shoes of a character who's living through a catastrophic event that's a result of climate change. And it can also help readers to just imagine what those effects look like in a very personal way.
Amy, you've interviewed dozens of writers for your column. Tell us what trends you've seen. You know, I'm thinking, are you surprised maybe about ways that writers are incorporating these big issues into their writing?
Yeah, absolutely. What I've been surprised about probably the most is just the wide swath of writing styles. You know, climate fiction is not a new phenomenon. It exists at least since the 1960s when science fiction writers were grappling with issues of climate change. But in more recent years, I've seen writers working in all types of styles, from science fiction to fantasy to realist, or some people might call it literary fiction, even romance. People are incorporating climate change into stories that 30, 40 years ago would never have touched the subject.
Jenny, your latest novel called Weather is about a woman named Lizzie who's grappling with the growing burden of climate change. But it's also about a lot of other things like her marriage, her relationship with her brother, who's also a recovering addict, and her responsibilities as a mom. Can you talk about the tension between her anxieties around climate change and then the smaller anxieties around like her day-to-day life?
I think what I was trying to do in Weather is to give a sense of what it's like for someone to kind of toggle back and forth between their everyday concerns and these larger, more existential questions. And my sense, at least in my own life, is that it often is kind of a flickering in and out of consciousness. One moment you're thinking about an article you've read, about enormous numbers of animals and insects going extinct and sort of imagining a world with that kind of absence in it. And the next minute you're reading a story to your child where all the animals in it are happy and helpful and taking you down the road to a new adventure. Mm. And I think there's some cognitive dissonance that goes on as we try to hold this imagined world, which still is secure and stable in our minds, with the really undeniable evidence of the rolling mm-hmm. disasters that are coming down the pike and have already come in some cases.
And you've got to toggle between these two things in your writing, too. So I'm wondering, do you identify with Lizzie's struggle to reconcile the scope of something like climate change or even this pandemic that we're going through right now with like the more
Absolutely.
Mundane things in your life?
Absolutely. I think I've always been interested in the idea that possibly the things that we label as mundane are less mundane than we think. And so I feel like the dailiness of life, a lot of that involves the ways that we take care of other people and the responsibilities we have towards those around us, ideally beyond the family group and towards neighbors and friends. And one thing that I think that is true both with the climate emergency and with the pandemic we're living through right now is that question of what is my responsibility to the common good. Mm-hmm. I know I think about that a lot personally. And for me, writing this novel was partly because I myself kind of fell through that rabbit hole of wondering, wait, do I have to worry about the whole world? Maybe I do, once I saw the math of it.
Right. Lydia, you've been writing about climate change for years now in your fiction work. With all that's changed in the past decade, tell us how your writing has also evolved.
Well, you know, I came to climate change through fear of extinction. You know, it's fashionable now to speak of climate change anxiety, but I think far more honest to say fear. Mm. You know, to just frankly use the term fear when we speak of the great acceleration of animal and plant extinctions
right.
that human behavior is causing, and the transformation of our life support systems, you know, our climate and everything it involves that's happening before our eyes. You know, because anxiety can be tamed. Anxiety can be managed. And to me, the point is here, with apologies to the therapists out there, mm-hmm. not to manage our feelings so that we can live with them more peacefully.
Right.
But exactly the opposite. It's to name our fear and name the causes of that fear. Fear is what makes us fight, not a little bit of anxiousness. And we need to fight now. We need to be very clear on that point, that this is a fight for a livable planet and a planet that's still alive.
Is that fear driving maybe more of an appetite for folks who want to get into books that deal so candidly with climate change?
Well, you know, I think fiction is great when it comes to climate change and the extinction crisis. You know, all the most beautiful and terrible things we do as human beings, we do with words, right? Law, policy, religion, art. Also, the bomb, the first atomic bomb, was made of words. Math is a language, too. The symbols of mathematics and physics are just proxies for words. So nuclear weapons are directly, specifically made of words. Couldn't have come into being without them. We can end ourselves with words, but we can also save ourselves. We know our gods only through words, mm-hmm. right? And fiction is great when it comes to climate change and the extinction crisis. But the kind of words that we make in policy and law are, to me, even better because those things are made of the words that are enforceable, right? Words that turn into actions and things. Mm-hmm. The words we actually have to live by, but we need words everywhere in all media, right? In fiction, in nonfiction, in newspapers, everywhere we exist to summon the collective will and force into action the political will to fight these threats to our existence and to the existence of everything that we love. We have to use words in other places like fiction, you know, to summon the will to make the policies and laws that have to be our weapons in this fight.
Lydia Millett is a writer and editor for the Center for Biological Diversity and author of A Children's Bible. Jenny Offill is author of Weather, a novel about a woman trying to balance the anxieties of climate change with daily life. And Amy Brady is the deputy publisher for Guernica Magazine and editor-in-chief of the Chicago Review of Books. Now, we also got this voicemail from a listener who, after reading a book about climate change, realized how far we are from solving the climate crisis.
My name is Chad, and I recently read David Wallace Wells' book, Life After Warming, and I found it really chilling. I believe the science that he cites is sound, and the book has really galvanized my belief that we have a lot of work to do, and it's probably changed me into a less fun friend because I have a harder time finding joy in everyday things if they have implications for the environment or even if they don't.
Amy, Life After Warming is a nonfiction book, but do you think that fiction writers have an opportunity here to offer some light and levity in like how they talk about climate change that maybe is a bit harder to do in nonfiction?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not so sure that the words light and levity are necessarily the opposite of fear.
I'm thinking more so in like striking the balance between being hopeful and then writing the hard truth.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, here's the thing that I find really valuable about novels is that they allow for a wide emotional range. You know, we so often talk about climate change in terms of an emotional duality, right? Either hope or hopelessness, you know, fear or placidity. But, you know, really, as human beings, we can encompass so much at once. You know, that's what makes us such, you know, unique mammals on this planet. And novels, you know, by, you know, their very function of being stories about, you know, different people who evolve over a course of time can encompass all of those things. And some of the finest works of climate fiction that I've read, you know, kind of encompass all of those emotions and then gesture toward a future where I hesitate to say hope because that just feels a little too simplistic, but towards a kind of collective action where people have finally got it, that this is a crisis, that this is a climate emergency, and that action is needed now.
Lydia, I'm wondering, you know, do you think that writing can actually make climate change seem like an even more immediate threat, you know, juxtaposed with something like coronavirus, which is killing thousands of people right now? Climate change can seem like a more cosmic threat.
You know, it's always been hard to write about these macro-social, these vast issues that it's hard to deal with in our personal lives, as Jenny was saying. Our lives are the present and the near and the now, right? And they're made up of the things the people around us need and the stuff we have to do to stay alive. And I think the only way to write in fiction about these sort of vast overarching things is to make stories out of people and to make the stories compelling enough. And also I do think to make the stories contain humor. Jenny's book has humor in it. My new book has some humor in it. You know, I wanted to write a book that sort of spoke of these weighty things, but also that also offered humor in the way that the children in the book interact with each other and the way they see their parents, who they're very angry at over their failure to confront the sort of dawning apocalypse. But you can. And it's difficult to find the balance between to find a place for humor in a discussion that goes so far beyond the human and so far into the abstract and so far into the future, really. How do we imagine a future of absence? Mm-hmm. I think that fiction and poetry and other forms of art can do that because they're places for feeling as well as for thought. And they also involve readers in this kind of intimate conversation between minds, this intimate conversation between private minds, so the mind of the reader and the mind of the writer. And it's a chance to sort of use that interior space to evoke really the truth of our feelings about how we live in the natural world, mm-hmm. our love for it, our love for animals and trees and plants, because most Americans, for example, really do love the wild, really right. do love wild creatures and don't want them to go away. And yet this is something that somehow gets forgotten in public policy debates or in the dryness of the news cycle. I think we need to remember our love, and I think that fiction can take us there.
For sure. Jenny, I was wondering if you could read us an excerpt from your novel, Weather?
Yes, be happy to.
Yeah.
The only lead-in, really, that I need for this is just that Lizzie is going to a lecture given by her former professor, who's now a podcast, who does podcasts about climate change. I'm late for the lecture now. By the time I get there, Sylvia is almost through speaking. There's a big crowd. Behind her is a graph shaped like a hockey stick. What it means to be a good person, a moral person, is calculated differently in times of crisis than in ordinary circumstances, she says. She pulls up a slide of people having a picnic by a lake. Blue skies, green trees, white people. Suppose you go with some friends to the park to have a picnic. This act is, of course, morally neutral. But if you witness a group of children drowning in the lake and you continue to eat and chat, you have become monstrous. The moderator makes a gesture to show that it's time to wrap up. A line of men is forming behind the microphone. I have both a question and a comment, they say. A young woman stands up to ask her question. How do you maintain your optimism? I can't get to Sylvia afterwards. I walk to the subway, trying to think about the world. Young person worry. What if nothing I do matters? Old person worry. What if everything I do does?
There's a lot happening in this scene. We have just about a minute before we need to take a pause. Tell us what's going on here and what was going through your head when you sat down to write it, Jenny?
Well, I was thinking about... I feel like the main character of my novel, Lizzie, I think most of us know a Lizzie, someone that is always taking in the problems of the people around her, not only her family, but also strangers. In the scene that precedes this, she's worrying about the car service man and how he doesn't have any customers anymore. And so she takes his car, even though she can't afford to. And I think the question of how do we extend these circles of care beyond the people that we know we have an obligation to, how do we extend it to strangers? One of the things that's been very interesting about the pandemic, of course, is that in the midst of this great tragedy, there has been urgent and collective action that is meant to help strangers as well as those close to us. And I think what Sylvia is saying in her talk.
Let's just take a quick pause, Jenny. I'll get you to finish that in just a moment. More from our guests and from you when we return.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Hey, it's Guy Raz from NPR's How I Built This, and each week on the show during this unprecedented crisis, I'll be asking some of the top founders and builders how they're dealing with the economic impact of the coronavirus and hear about some of the ways they're pivoting to fight it. Subscribe or listen now to How I Built This.
How do you grapple with a global issue as huge as climate change while taking care of all the mundane tasks that take up our day-to-day? It's a question fiction writers are tackling in their work, including novelist Jenny Offal. Lydia Millett, and Amy Brady, editor-in-chief of the Chicago Review of Books. Jenny, I want to jump back to you. We just heard that lovely excerpt from your book, and you were talking about sort of what it was like to work out this scene and what was going through your head as you sat down to write it.
I think, I guess, in short, what was going through my head was that we hear a lot about climate change denial, that phrase, and we think we know what it means. But in this novel, I was interested in what I came to think of as kind of a softer form of denial, which is when we begin to understand how dire the emergency is, but we still don't want to look directly at it. And this is a very early scene when the narrator isn't ready to look directly at what's being talked about. She's kind of in that soft form of, if I don't look at it, maybe it will go away.
Amy, one of the writers that you've interviewed, Omar Alakad, told you that he was less concerned about getting the science right in his novel than he was about getting human behavior right. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, that was one of my favorite interviews that I think I've done, because Omar is just such an incredibly smart person in general. And then his writing, of course, reflects that just glittering intelligence and insight that he has. And what he was talking about is this was during a live talk, and someone from the audience had asked him, how important is it that fiction writers get the science right in their novels? This is something that I hear over and over again as a question. And what he said is that for him, it's not really a matter of getting it right or wrong. It's not really an issue for him at all. Because again, if all people had to know was that, you know, there's a scientific consensus about climate change, then, you know, we wouldn't be in, you know, this mire of, you know, of political, you know, conversation about this all the time. We would have solved climate change. So instead, what he focuses on is the irrationality of human behavior to drive that home to readers. Mm-hmm. And by irrationality, what he means is that our consistent reliance on fossil fuels, even though we know we are destroying ourselves and every living thing on this planet by using them. So I just thought that was such a brilliant comment.
And Amy, I want to read you an email we got from Craig here. Craig says, I just finished reading American War by Omar Alakad. And I'm having all my students in my first year English composition courses read the first three chapters. Without speculative fiction, it is hard for people to imagine what life in America would really be like should the seas rise 50 feet above their present level, a lot of farmland become barren, and storms grow much more severe. All these are things that happen in American war. Your thoughts?
I think that teacher's absolutely right, and I'm delighted to hear that you know, he's exposing so many other people to that book. One of the things that this book really drives home is the relationship between climate change, a limitation in resources, and conflict, and that those things really can't be separated if we want to understand their origins and to, you know, ultimately mitigate those things. Unfortunately, too often outside of novels, like, for example, in news reports, you know, we do see those things separated, or at least there's an absence of commentary on how they're connected.
Right. Jenny, you studied the psychology behind human inaction when you were doing research for your novel. What did you find?
One of the things that I found, which I thought was interesting, sort of seeing it play out again with our current crisis, is the normalcy bias, where people really have trouble imagining that what will happen in the future is really going to be fundamentally different than how things are now. That really is one of the things that also keeps us from acting, because our brains are, of course, to some extent, pattern-recognizing machines. And when we don't recognize the pattern of what's coming down, and of course, what's happening with climate change is unprecedented, we have a hard time mustering ideas of what we should do about it. And there's a behavior where we... disaster psychologists call it milling. And milling is what people do in situations where they are trying to figure out if something is a disaster or not. I think during the pandemic, for me, it involved sort of desperately trying to figure out, taking inventory of what food we had and what we needed, but it takes different forms in different places.
Allie tweeted to us, she said, "I've really enjoyed reading science fiction about climate change. The Wind-Up Girl by Paolo Bacigalupi really made me think about the effects of climate change on our diets and social structures. Thinking about all the possibilities of climate change on our futures is really important." Amy, you know, cli-fi, which is shorthand for climate fiction, but also an ode to sci-fi, has been around for a long time. We heard you mention before it dates back to the 1960s, I believe you said. And Octavia Butler and Margaret Atwood, of course, two well-known writers who've written cli-fi novels that we can think of. Can you just talk about the influence of science fiction on climate change novels?
Yeah, sure. So, like I said, I think that we could fairly say it dates back to the 1960s. I mean, we could arguably say, you know, that depictions of climate in literature goes all the way back to the Epic of Gilgamesh. But I think in terms of contemporary literature, the 1960s, and specifically the novels of J.G. Ballard, are really the origin point. And what he was doing there that was so distinctive from so many novels before him is that he was exploring not just climate change, but the fact that it's caused by human activity. And was setting his novels in a, you know, future time when humanity was kind of grappling with the end and looking back at how all the decisions that they had made to destroy the earth had left them in this state of despair. And so his novels were a huge, huge influence on the science fiction community, to the point where many science fiction authors that I read today say that cite him as an influence, but then also have said that it's almost impossible to write a work of science fiction that doesn't grapple with climate change, since so much of science fiction is imagining what a future will look like.
Lydia, let's jump to you. I'd love to hear you read for us an excerpt from A Children's Bible.
Sure. So this actually is not out yet. It'll be out in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
But it is the story of a group of kids and teenagers who are kind of being forced to spend the summer in this rambling house with their parents, whom they dislike and resent. And a great storm has come and flooded the house and partly destroyed it. And so this is a really brief scene from after the storm, after the floodwaters recede. On the third day, hundreds of dying fish lay flapping on what used to be the lawn, an enormous mud flat interrupted by islands of bush. Jack and Shell, Jack is her little brother, by the way, the narrator's little brother. Jack and Shell splashed desperately back and forth from the mud to the real lake, carrying buckets of fishes. It was a race against time, so some of us helped them. For those that died before they could be saved, the boys dug a mass grave. They piled the fish bodies inside it and conducted a funeral service with readings from Jack's Bible. My peace I give you, read Jack sadly. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Do not be afraid. Shell had made a sign. His verse was written on it in block letters. He held it up in front of his chest for us to see. Are not five sparrows sold for two pennies? And yet not one of them is forgotten by God.
Mm. We are living right now, Lydia, in a time that really does feel a lot like it's the end of the world. And, you know, A Children's Bible will be coming out in the midst of all this. So do you think that the message or the meaning of your novel has changed for you to meet the current context?
I don't think it's changed. I think it's relevant because it's a lot about our sort of the way we use the world and the way my generation, I guess, has refused to confront this apparent apocalypse.
Yeah.
And you know, the pandemic is a direct result of our exploitation of wildlife, our abuse of wildlife in the natural world. You know, we know that it most likely originated from, you know, either horseshoe bats or pangolins or civets or a combination of them with industrial agriculture. And so this is exactly
yeah.
what is bringing us all these other ills that, you know, that are involved in the transformation of the climate and the sixth mass extinction. And so, and also in the book, everyone's stuck in place. They're sheltering in place for large portions of the book.
And
and so there's also sort of a direct parallel. I think there's a kind of odd limbo here in the pandemic. We're in this strange limbo, and that means we're sort of paralyzed and at the same time in the midst of emergency. And I think that crises can often feel like that, as though we're sort of suspended. We're suspended in time. Everything is strange and alien, unfamiliar. And yet at the same time, there's this urgency behind it all. And this sort of this desperation and confusion.
Well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk a little bit more about cli-fi, climate fiction, right after this. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. This is 1A.
We live in a culture that prizes action. But now, former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy says it's important to make space to just be.
Simply spending 5 minutes just listening to the birds chirping or to the conversation around you.
Solitude and ways to overcome loneliness on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
This is 1A. We've spent Earth Day talking about climate change. And I want to steal a question from one of the characters in the passage from Weather that we heard earlier in the show. Jenny, how do you maintain your optimism right now?
I maintain my optimism, if that's the right word for it, by remembering how much I don't know about the future. One of the things that happens, I think, when you begin to think about these big existential problems is you may go through a period of trying to research your way out of it, figure out where you can live, figure out what you could do, figure out what you could keep in your cabinets. But none of that ultimately is going to save any of us. The way that humans have always made it through terrible moments in time is by forming collective groups and problem solving together. And I feel like I am heartened by the fact that people were able to act for the common good in this current crisis. But I know that I was joking the other day to someone, you know, pandemic was not on my apocalypse bingo card of where we were going to go. And certainly it wasn't on anything that I thought would give the climate a momentary respite. But I think that one of the ways that we got into this situation is by our hubris as humans of feeling that we are not part of nature, but that we live outside of it and have dominion over it. And I think there's a lot of unknowns into terms of what will help. But I do feel like at this point, it isn't so much about individual action. It's about finding an area that you care about and acting with others together to protect that. And in so doing, feel that you're living ethically in a damaged world.
Yeah, on the same token, here's a tweet from John. He says, Kim Stanley Robinson writes great cli-fi because he takes a lemonade from lemons approach, painting a world profoundly and sometimes horribly changed by climate change, yet inhabited by people who push on and make a world they can live in. Also, another listener tweeted, John Brunner's The Sheep Look Up can easily be considered a classic of cli-fi. Pollution touches all levels of life in the book, and nothing happens without being pushed by the climate disaster always at work there. Amy, quick question before we go. It's a great time to do some reading, so can you just recommend some climate fiction for our listeners? We've got about 30 seconds.
Sure. Well, Kim Stanley Robinson's 2140 is a great recommendation. The person who tweeted that book is absolutely right. It's a book that is, despite its dire subject matter, is actually quite funny and does have an element of hope to it. I would also recommend Amitabh Ghosh's Gun Island, which draws on Bengali mythology to help explain the weirdness of climate change and all of the strange effects that we're seeing it have on our world today. And then Thirdly, I would recommend Pachaya Sidbenthad's Bangkok Wakes to Rain, which is set in Bangkok over the course of more than a century. And we get to see how that city, which today is very much imperiled by climate change, has been altered by the rising seas.
Thanks, Amy Brady, deputy publisher for Guernica Magazine and editor-in-chief of the Chicago Review of Books. Also, Jenny Offill, author of Weather, and Lydia Millett, author of A Children's Bible. Thank you all. Before we go, it's time for another act of kindness. Every day, we're sharing different stories from listeners across the United States about the bits of brightness that they've seen during these dark times. Today's story comes from Don in Cleveland, Ohio.
I pulled my motorcycle out of storage and brought it to our condo building, which doesn't have a garage to park in. We had some strong winds a couple weeks ago, and it blew my cover off, and I have no idea where it went. And a couple days later, I walked outside and there was a different cover on my motorcycle. So somebody had put a cover on it for me. I have no idea who did it or where it's from, but it might seem like a small gesture, but to me it was it really put a smile on my face to know somebody cared and took the time to put a cover on it for me because it snowed the next day.
Thanks so much for sharing your story, Don. If you have an act of kindness to share, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 855-236-1212. We read them all, I promise. The number again is 855-236-1212. And just as a heads up, starting tomorrow, NPR's national correspondent Sarah McCammon is hosting the show for the next few days. This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.